Thank you, Tony. Thanks for inviting me. Can you all hear me, by the way? I have this terrible cold that's going around that everyone's had for weeks.
I will.
Good, good. Where was I? Yes, thank you. Protein folding. Henry was nice enough to give us a bit of an introduction a few weeks ago to some of the basic issues in protein chemistry, what are proteins, etc. Just for the sake of making sure we're all to level the playing field just a little bit, though, I'll go over one brief, quick overview slide. So what we're looking at here, what I'm looking at, is protein folding kinetics. Go back to the real basics. What are proteins? Proteins are just polymers of amino acids. In a human being, there's about 100,000 different kinds of protein. Each one of those 100,000 different proteins has its own unique three-dimensional shape. That shape is absolutely critical to function, because proteins are tools, effectively, and all tools, for all tools, form defines function. Now, there's a bit of a discrepancy here, though. Now, polymers are more or less linear strings. Tools are these three-dimensional objects. So there's a coding problem here. And that is, how does that sequence of amino acids, that floppy linear chain, encode a single unique biologically active structure? Now, a lot of research groups are working on that problem. Turns out technologically it's relatively easy to determine what the sequence of a protein is, and rather difficult to determine what its structure is. And so there's a backlog. There's something like 3 million known protein sequences and about 8,000 different known protein structures. So there's been a great deal of effort in trying to figure out how exactly it is that sequence encodes structure. Now, that's a tough thermodynamic problem, right? Really, we want to know how this sequence encodes a single ground state configuration that's more stable than any other minima. And that is a really tough problem. Like, get just a single atom, a tenth of a nanometer off in your simulation, and the energies of these things will skyrocket. So this has turned out to be an extraordinarily recalcitrant problem. How sequence-defined structure is really a difficult problem. So I've avoided that. That's not what my research group studies. What my research group studies is the biological mechanism. How does an unfolded polypeptide chain find that unique ground state configuration? What I hope to show you in this talk is that that actually is an enormously, conceptually, a much simpler problem than how it encodes that final three-dimensional structure. Now, this is one of the reasons, and this, maybe it's not surprising to you that I say that's a simpler process. In fact, from the perspective of a chemist, that's an extraordinarily simple reaction. This chemical reaction I'm going to tell you about is just some polymer chain folding up. We're not breaking or forming any covalent bonds. And for small molecules, that sort of conformational change happens extraordinarily fast. For cyclohexane, for instance, where there's two minima, a chair and boat configuration, the small molecule rapidly jumps back and forth between these two configurations in like nanoseconds, just because of random thermal fluctuations. Protein folding, similarly, is just a conformational change and could conceivably be just as simple as a random search that's driven by random thermal fluctuations. But when we apply the known rates of small molecule conformational changes to the protein folding problem, we get a completely nonsensical result. It turns out this unfolded polymer chain is so flexible, it has so many degrees of freedom available to it, that to randomly search through all possible configurations to find the one correct one would take enormously longer than the age of the universe. Right? I mean, this is not astronomically large, this is supra-astronomically large. Clearly that's wrong, right? I mean, proteins in reality fold in less than a second. They have to, or we wouldn't be here, right? I mean, there's an intense selective evolutionary pressure to make these things fold up fast enough for the organism to use them. You know, I like this fact, this discrepancy. I mean, I think the random search model is actually a pretty reasonable model. It is how small molecules work. I think it's rather rare that reasonable models fail so spectacularly. I mean, this is a 50 or 60 order of magnitude discrepancy here. And that really hits home a point. What we are looking for is how this process is sped up. And we're not looking for something subtle, right? I mean, we're not talking 1,800 votes in Florida here. We're talking a 50 order of magnitude kind of effect. That makes my life a lot easier. Yes. Yeah. That absolutely could be true, and you know, best I can tell, there's no way to address that. We can never know if you're at the ground state or just some kinetic trap. But the numbers are effectively the same. You know, do you find the one ground state or do you find the one kinetic trap out of the 10 to the 80th possible configurations? By the way, I think it is the thermodynamic ground state most often, but it proved me wrong. All right. Now before I tell you about some of the insights we've generated into how this process might be sped up, let me briefly tell you how, as an experimentalist, I study the folding reaction. Now conceptually, 99% of our experiments are very straightforward. 99% of the time when we want to study protein folding, we take a protein, we take some folded protein that we've bought or that we've purified ourselves, we then transfer it into conditions where the unfolded state is the most favorable state. We unfold it, and then we rapidly jump it into conditions where the folded state is favored, and we watch as the system responds, as the system achieves its new equilibrium. About 90% of the time, we'll do that with a rapid mixing device, where we take a protein that's unfolded, say at low pH, or in the presence of some chemical denaturing agent. There are a number of small molecules like guanidine and urea that unfold proteins. We then rapidly mix it with some stabilizing buffer that encourages it to fold in a stop flow device, and we can mix in on the order of a millisecond. And then we watch, typically spectroscopically, as the protein folds up. Now, we've got a wide array. Sure. Pardon? Well, to a limited extent, that's a semantic question, because we need a good definition of unfolded, and actually that's something my group's working on too. But there's no indication of a stable structure. So in these chemically unfolded states, the chain seems to be pretty well approximated as a fully random chain. Protons can get in and out to the backbone of the chain just as fast in these unfolded proteins as they can in short peptides. There's lots of evidence that suggests these things truly are unfolded. Yes. Yeah, I may or may not show those data. Yeah, so Andre is pointing out, one of the things... that's absolutely true. And in fact, in many cases, they seem to approximate a random chain, those radius of gyration. Lots of evidence that they're unfolded. A perhaps more subtle question, I've taken a protein and unfolded it chemically. What I really want to know is what's going on in the cell when it's first synthesized. So maybe my chemically unfolded state is different than the unfolded state that crops up in the cell in water. We can test that by looking at different chemical denaturing agents. And every time we do that, we get exactly the same results. The results I'm going to tell you are the same irrespective of how we've unfolded the protein. It also makes me think that we've really unfolded all the way. So, as I'll get to in a moment, we study just the smallest, simplest proteins, and for those, it's almost always the folding reaction's reversible. As Emma has pointed out, though, for some larger proteins, particularly larger proteins than us eukaryotes, if you chemically unfold the protein, not all of the molecules will fold back. There are kinetic traps. Most of the kinetic traps are probably bi or higher order aggregates where multiple chains come together. So small proteins vary is the answer. Well, that's a good question. First, let's talk about all the different spectroscopic techniques that we have available. Well, it turns out we've got really an impressive arsenal of tools now. We have spectroscopic probes that can characterize almost every property of the native state. For various systems, we can watch. Andre was nice enough to talk to us a few weeks ago about protein structure. Let me segue again. This is just a cartoon of the backbone of the polymer. In reality, this backbone has side chains coming off of it, So when a protein folds up, it's really a dense, solid mass of atoms. The backbones tend to often take on regular elements of local structure, called secondary structure. And we have spectroscopic probes that specifically monitor secondary structure. We have spectroscopic probes that monitor hydrogen bond formation in the backbone, that can monitor how much side chains can wiggle, whether or not side chains are hidden from solvent. In a number of cases, there are biological assays. We can measure how fast activity is recovered, and we can measure overall molecular dimensions. Now, if a protein has a native degree of local structure, native activity, native core packing, then I think, what is it? If it walks, talks, and quacks like a duck, the safest assumption is that it is a duck. So these things do really seem to fold all the way. At the very least, they fold to active states, and that's all the body cares about anyway. Now, all right, so we've got all of these different spectroscopic tools. We can monitor every aspect of protein structure as structure is forming. What happens when we apply that set of tools to the protein folding problem? Well, historically, when the first members of my community started to look at proteins, they were looking at bigger proteins, proteins like lysozyme and myoglobin. And what they saw, well, here's lysozyme, is that at least a partial answer to that 50 order of magnitude problem came out. What they saw was that when you go from an initially unfolded state, you very rapidly form those elements of local structure. Those elements of local structure then collapse to form an ensemble of relatively compact states, but not as compact as the final structure, but relatively compact, relatively fluid configurations called the molten globule. And this molten globule jiggles and wiggles around until it finally forms the native state. And so what we saw here is, again, at least a partial solution to that 50 order of magnitude problem. And that is that the kinetic barrier is not just one huge barrier associated with the entropy of this random search, but instead you've split it up into a bunch of coupled barriers. Right? Local secondary structural elements have some thermodynamic stability associated with them. And so while there's some entropic cost that you pay in making this, in finding these intermediate structures, that's reduced by the enthalpic payback that you get. And similarly, these collapse states, very greasy, water-hating amino acids, and so there's some energetic payback to the fact that there are fewer condensed states than there are open states with just local structure. So these early results suggested that evolution, that nature has solved the folding kinetics problem in the same way it solves almost every kinetic problem. It's broken one big barrier down, this entropy of a random search, into a bunch of smaller barriers. And of course, the rate over several smaller barriers is much faster than the rate over one big one.
When you eat food, the enzymes break the stuff up into
That's right.
pieces, right?
That's right.
Why these pieces are then put together? Why can it fold if it's put them together? Or they have put together proteins a long time and then fold?
We'll touch back on that in the end, one of my last slides.
Okay.
That's right. Really use a glass of water.
Thanks.
Gene's seen this talk before. But thanks, Tony. And I probably want to pick on you at some time in the next minute or two. Anyway. All right. So, wait, we've solved the problem, right? You know, we've broken this big random search into one that's guided by thermodynamics, but one that's guided by enthalpy. Well, historically, that was the perspective in this field. And I cleverly noted that this is how the field looked a decade ago. But then, at the turn of the 90s, some interesting new results came up. Alan Hirsch at Cambridge started to look at the folding kinetics of this small protein. It's a 62 amino acid protein. It's a protease inhibitor from barley. But barley makes it to keep bugs from eating barley. And what Hirsch saw was that, unlike the larger proteins people looked at previously, this protein folds in a highly concerted process, extremely well approximated as a two-state process. Right? They initiate folding, and it takes snapshots, and at any given instant, they never see anything but a mixture of unfolded and folded states. They never see well-populated, partially structured intermediates.
What's the time scale?
So folding time is, thank you. The folding time is, the intrinsic time constant of this reaction is about a 60th of a second. Time resolution of the experiments are milliseconds. But it's almost not a time resolution issue. It's more of a population issue. So the experiments are very good. If they'd seen any well-populated intermediate, irrespective of how fast it's formed, they can put constraints on the population. There's no population of well-structured intermediate states. Sorry. That's clearly wrong, right? I mean, there have to be partially folded states during folding. This is not a tunneling process through the folding barrier. What their results put a very tight constraint on is the population of these partially folded states. So we know that before some rate-limiting step in the process, that every partially folded state that gets occupied on this pathway is high in energy relative to the unfolded state. And that's all we're saying here. Now, we have, this two-state model, again, is clearly a model, so it's just a model, and it's clearly wrong. There must be other states in the process, but we have a lot of data constraining it now, right? And if you have some well-populated state, in some way its biophysics is going to be different than the physics of the starting material. It'll have local structure, or it'll be more collapsed, or in some way it will be different. And so if you look with multiple different time-resolved probes, you'll see some properties evolving faster than others. Here's a protein we looked at a few years ago. Here we're looking at the rate of loss of unfolded material, recovery of the packing of amino acids in the core. This is the recovery of local elements of structure. This is the recovery of aromatic side chains being forced into asymmetric environments. This is the recovery of packing away the core and hiding it from solvent. And in this case, we've even got recovery of biological activity. And all of these occur with identical kinetics. So we see no indication from this experiment that, well, at least from the end of the dead time, right? We take a millisecond to mix things. But from the end of that 1 millisecond dead time to the end of the experiment, there's only one process going on, and you've only got two states being populated. Yeah. Something we've done more recently. A two-state process will look, the decay curve will look single exponential. We started to hammer away at that pretty hard, and we see absolutely no evidence of anything but single exponential kinetics. Maybe we can trap intermediates if we go to low temperatures. We're a little bit constrained there because this has to occur in water or in something approximating water. And using things that approximate water, we can only get down to 15 below. But still, no evidence of anything but single exponential kinetics. Seems to be a two-state process. We've even looked back to see if maybe there's something fast happening during that first millisecond that we can't look at. That's a debatable question. So, do the rates obey Arrhenius behavior as a function of temperature? They don't. If you look at a plot of log rate versus 1 over T, you don't get a straight line. You get a curved line. But there's another effect going on here. There's a big heat capacity change when a protein folds up. And that means the stability of the protein, the stability of that rate limiting step, changes a function of temperature. So it's not only the barrier attempt rate that changes the function temperature, but even the barrier height does. So we know why the behavior is not Arrhenius. Yeah. Actually, it's debated in the field, but I think we know why. Sorry, I'm taking too long. I'm going to skip this. Just trust me. Nothing happens in the dead time either. The two-state model, which is clearly wrong, really holds very well. Now, that leaves us in a bit of a pickle. On the one hand, there's a conundrum here, right? For these, the early proteins, the first proteins people looked at, we could see this sort of downhill hierarchy of structure that guides the process and accelerates the process. And here, that hierarchy is invisible. There's an intellectual difficulty here. There's also a technical difficulty. As an experimental biophysicist, I was trained to use all those biophysical probes to characterize these intermediates. There aren't any here. Every probe we throw at this process says the same thing. Everyone tells us the rate of formation of this, because all parts of structure form simultaneously.
So this is for that one protein. Are there other examples?
There, we now have data on about 36 proteins that fold this way. And it turns out to be, and there's a nice rule of thumb that's almost perfectly obeyed. Every protein under 110 amino acids folds this way, with about two exceptions. And every protein over 110 amino acids behaves that way with two exceptions, two in each direction. So it does seem to be a fundamental process, this two-state folding. And for me, it's a somewhat more appealing process for a couple of reasons. One, folding's complicated, so I want to study the simplest systems with the hope that the physics of the problem will be most readily apparent in the simplest system. On the other hand, we don't have any direct means of watching what's going on during this mechanism, so we're forced to use indirect means. No. Well, okay. So, one or two research groups have learned how to build proteins. That is, well, they're still polypeptides, so they're polyamino acids just like proteins are, but they're structures that have not previously been seen in, so they're sequences that have not previously been seen in nature. I actually have similar structures. So a couple of research groups have algorithms, that you tell the computer, here's the structure I want, you tell me what sequence, we'll fold to that, it spits out a sequence of amino acids, they build it, and it folds. Actually, we're starting to characterize the folding kinetics of those in my lab. We just got some data on that. I'll come back to that at the end. Jim? Oh, absolutely. You can even dial that up by, remember, we're chemically unfolding these. If you don't add as much of the chemical that unfolds them, you can change that equilibrium the equilibrium constant to be anything you want it to be. That's correct. Rapidly flopping back and forth with the rates that we measure. Where was I? Oh, other than proteins, no one has ever built a heteropolymer that folds to a unique sequence. I would love to see. So you see why. When I get to the end of the talk, I think you'll see why I'm very curious as to whether or not other heteropolymers that have unique structures fold in the same way proteins do. Most of the dominant theories of folding kinetics, if you'll agree with me on this, stipulate that evolution plays a critical role in this. That of a 10,000 sequences of amino acids that can fold to a given structure, only a small fraction of them will fold fast. These proteins that people have designed were never under selective pressure to fold fast. The question is, do they fold as fast as naturally occurring questions? Sorry, naturally occurring proteins. If I forget to address that question, ask me later. Let's see. Where was I? Oh, yes. So there is no direct method, experimental method, for determining what's going on here. So we're forced to move on into indirect methods. And the approach that we've taken stems from the fact that if you look across these 36 proteins that are known to have this behavior, that the fastest, most rapidly folding of them folds a million times faster than the slowest. Right? So we've got a great, wide, wonderfully wide dynamic range to try and capture with some theory of the process. Well, so we set out some years ago to try and figure out what it is that makes this protein fold a million times faster than this protein. Now, first thing we need to do, of course, is to figure out what some of the variables might be. Okay, Tony, what makes this protein different than that protein? Do not say blue versus red. That's right. Well, so these are the intrinsic rate constants. So that means in a fifth of a second. You're correct. So in 5 seconds, 1/E of the protein's molecules are folded versus in a few microseconds. So, all right, what makes two proteins different from one another? Yeah. Well, not necessarily more. We consider these strands to be secondary structure too, but different secondary structure, right? This is four helices packed together. This is two helices packed on a plane, on a sheet. So we call issues like that secondary structure content. Other issues like this is a up, down, four helix bundle You can have up, up, down, down, and all the other permutations. Actually, not all the other permutations. Anyway, we protein chemists refer to all of those structural issues incorrectly as the topology of the protein. Now, you guys know, of course, that these all are strings, so they have the same topology. We just co-opted the word. It's really the geometry of the protein, but I have trouble using the correct nomenclature. Anyway, so topology is one of the variables. Anyone else care to take a stab at this? Come on, Jim. What makes two proteins different from one another? David? Actually, Jim almost hit on one a moment ago in your question. Right? So we add denaturant and we change the equilibrium constant. Changing the equilibrium constant is exactly equivalent to changing the stability of the protein. Like the stability of the folded state relative to the unfolded state. And different proteins have different stabilities. Now it's a thermodynamic property, not a kinetic property. But a number of theory groups have suggested that there should be a correlation between the thermodynamic stability of a protein and how fast it folds. So stability is another potential parameter we want to look at. Anyone else? Like chemistry, sure. That's even a subtle one, right? I mean, in some respects. But these are compact folded structures. So we're talking about the chemistry of all those amino acid side chains interacting with one another. That's sort of the most fundamental difference. And that's closely tied up with the most fundamental difference, which is sequence. I mean, that's really the only thing that makes two proteins different from one another. Folding is spontaneous, so sequence defines topology, and it defines stability. And it defines the other global variable I'm talking about, which is the size. These proteins are of different lengths. Sequence defines those other three. On the other hand, we can separate them. We know of pairs of proteins with completely different sequences, but they have very similar structures. We know of proteins with completely different sequences with the same stability, and different sequences, obviously, with the same length. So we want to ask, across this million-fold range of rates, is it two proteins with the same size that fold with the same rate? Two proteins with the same stability that fold with the same rate? Or is it so sensitive to sequence that if we just change one out of those 100 amino acids, that we've moved all over this million-fold range? Well, if that's true, then we're all kind of screwed if our goal is a quantitative theoretical model of this, right? If it's so sensitive to sequence, well, that's been the problem with fold prediction. Well, we can address each of these in turn. We've been endeavoring to isolate these four variables. Well, sequence is easy enough to look at as an experimentalist these days. We use molecular biology and we can go in and we can change any amino acid we want in a protein. Now, many groups have now done this, taken one of these small proteins and changed one amino acid at a time. So this is, actually this slide's old, this is about 20 different point mutations in this protein. For this particular protein, we now have data on about 95% of the positions. And what we see, so there's a bunch of point mutations, what we see is that even the most deleterious mutations in this part of the sequence only change the rate of folding by about a factor of 10. Now I stipulate that out of a million-fold range, a factor of 10 is small. So maybe there's some hope for us to generate a quantitative model of this process. Now, on the other hand, a point mutation is very trivial. No one has ever demonstrated a point mutation that, for instance, changes the structure of a protein in any significant way. The structure is very robust to sequence changes. And in fact, any two proteins with at least 20% of their sequence the same, I assure you, will have the same structure. The question is then, what happens when you start to make these wholesale changes? And you change 60, 70, 80% of the positions in a polypeptide chain. Well, we started to look at that. Started to look at sets of homologous proteins, proteins thought to come from a common ancestor and thus having some sequence similarity. This is two fibronectin type 3 domains. This is just a very common little structural motif in proteins of animals and us. This is just a sketch of their backbones. You see the structures are relatively similar. In fact, if you line up these two backbones, if you reduce the root mean squared deviation between the backbones to a minima, the root mean squared deviation between these two is 0.06 nanometers. I mean, these things have very similar structures. They have very similar sizes. This one has four amino acids inserted into this loop, so this loop's a bit longer. So this one's 94 amino acids, this one's 91. Very similar sizes, very similar structures, relatively different sequences. These are the two sequences. The vertical hash marks are the positions in which the sequences are the same. So more than 70% of the amino acids here have been changed between these two. Well, and the question is, what are their relative folding rates? Well, this protein, like most proteins, is fluorescent. Its fluorescence changes when it folds up. So we chemically unfold these two proteins, and then we dump them into conditions where the native state's favored, and we watch as the native state's recovered. Qualitatively, these two proteins, their folding kinetics look similar, but quantitatively, these are vastly different. Yeah, that's right. So the bottom one's in milliseconds. This is about a, and under these conditions, the folding rates differ by about a factor of 2,000th or so. Now we're getting somewhere, right? Million-fold range, factor 2,000 is at least semi-respectable chunk of that. But this experiment is a little bit unfair. Right? This is a dilution experiment. We're diluting away some denaturant. We can never go to infinite dilution. There's always some denaturant, some chemical unfolding agent left behind. These rates turn out to be very sensitive to that, and so maybe this rate's just more sensitive than this one. We can look at that by just looking at the rate as a function of that leftover denaturant. Well, and for reasons that have been a mystery for so long, everyone forgets that it's a mystery. There's a linear relationship between that denaturant concentration and the log of folding rates. That allows us to estimate what the folding rates would be in water. And even in water, we see that there's about a 400-fold difference in these folding rates. So two out of the, six orders of magnitude. Well, all right, so maybe sequence accounts for something, except we haven't accounted for all the variables here. These two proteins have the same structure, same topology. They have the same length, more or less. It's the longer one that folds faster. But we thought stability might be a determinant, too. And these two proteins have different stabilities. This is not such a meaningful slide for this crowd. We can measure stabilities experimentally. And what we find is that the rapidly folding one has a stability of about 10 times kT. And the slowly folding one has a stability of about twice kT. So there's a very large discrepancy in the stabilities of these two proteins. Now, from this plot, I know I can determine the stability of these two proteins as a function of denaturant concentration. I showed you a moment ago their folding rates as a function of denaturant concentration. So I can put those together, and I can show you the folding rates of these two proteins under different solvent conditions where their stabilities are different. So folding rate is a function of stability. To try and control for that last variable. And when we do that, that 400-fold discrepancy disappears. It's now about a 2-fold difference in folding rates. In fact, this has now been observed for a number of sets of related proteins. Whenever you have two proteins with the same structure, I'm not aware of any set of two proteins with the same structure whose folding rate differs by more than a factor of 20 when they're under equal stability, isostability conditions. Whereas in water, they can differ by up to a factor of 400. So we seem to be generating a rule here that stability is a sort of two-order of magnitude determinant, and some other fine details of the sequence are more like a one-order of magnitude change. Yes, I believe that is what I'm saying. This is for two related proteins with the same structure, which is interesting enough. Look at the line for just one protein. So these data points are the folding rates of a single protein under solvent conditions where the stabilities are different. The correlation coefficient there is like 0.999. And I never expect an experiment to have a correlation coefficient like that. So if you've got a single protein under different solvent conditions, the correlation between thermodynamics and kinetics is extraordinary. Should be constraining our theories. If you've got two proteins with the same structure and size, then the correlation between folding kinetics and thermodynamics is also pretty good. We've actually looked at larger sets of homologous proteins than just this one. The largest one to date has 6 members in it. Sorry, 7 members in it. For 6 of them, so this is a set of proteins that are related via a common ancestor. Across 6 of them, the correlation between folding rate and stability is quite good. There is an outlier. This outlier is not so serious. All of these proteins clearly arose from a common ancestor, but there's a difference. These 6 all have the same size and structure. This one has 18 amino acids inserted right in the middle of it. So this protein is about a third longer than these and has a different topology because of that insert. So we have this rule that if you've got proteins that have the same structure and same size and topology, there's a nice correlation between folding rates and length. Sorry, between folding rates and stability. If you change the length and or structure, all bets are off. Well, we can start to address that issue by looking, instead of sets of structurally similar proteins, by looking at unrelated proteins. As I said, we've characterized about 3 dozen of these proteins that fold in this concerted two-state fashion. We've gone through that list of 3 dozen and culled it down into a non-redundant list, where no 2 proteins on the list are related to one another. So this list is old. Our present data sets has more than 2 dozen proteins. And what we want to know is, do the folding rates of these proteins correspond with the stabilities of these proteins? There again is that million fold range of rates we're trying to capture. Well, here this correlation coefficient's not quite as good. Right. So I'm told by my favorite statistician, my wife, that this is on the ragged edge of statistical significance. It's got a p-value of exactly 5%. So hey, you know, this is not inconsistent with my hypothesis that stability is an important determinant. But clearly something or some things else are playing a more dominant role. I mean, we have many orders of magnitude scattered here. But fortunately, we still have 2 variables left. First of our remaining variables, I think, is a nice, straightforward, almost common sense variable, right? Bigger proteins should fold more slowly than a small protein. A number of our theoretical colleagues have gone on to generate more quantitative theories than that I just put forth. Typically saying that folding rate should scale with length to some power. 1.5 power is the probability of a random 3-dimensional walk coming back on itself. 1.3 power if it's a not infinitely thin chain. Other theorists have suggested that the exponent can be as big as 5 or 6. So strong length dependence in that latter case. Well, the exponent is certainly not 5 or 6. We do not see any correlation between the size of a protein and how fast it folds. Actually, this slide's old. We have data out to here now. And in fact, the one out here is up there. So very large proteins can fold very much faster than very small proteins. The error bars on this would be too small to see in general. Well, I don't think so. So I was a little unfair there. I said some theory groups had said that the exponent should be about 1.5. Well, the whole length scale here is only a factor of 2 or 3. What's 2 or 3 to the 1.5 power? In reality, they were predicting that length is a trivial determinant of folding kinetics, and they were right, apparently. All right, well, damn, now we're down to a single variable to try and capture all of this. Not only that, it's a tough variable to deal with in a quantitative sense, right? We're talking about, is it helix? Is it these helices? Is it these sheets? What's the arrangement of helices and sheets? We've never come up with, I don't think I've ever come up with, a good metric to try and quantify that. I mean, right, we want a quantitative metric. It was easy to look for, and nice to look for, a correlation between length and folding rates. How do we look for correlation, quantitative correlation, between stability and folding kinetics? So we cast about, didn't cast about much, came up with a metric that captures at least part of this issue of topology. We call it contact order. And what we've done here is taken the three-dimensional structure of the protein. Now remember, this is just a cartoon. Really, there are side chains coming off of here, and this is densely packed atoms. So we take that final structure of the product, and we ask, all right, what pairs of atoms are touching one another? Now, for a protein of this size, you probably have 5,000 pairs of atoms touching, 5 or 10,000. Across those 5 or 10,000 pairs, we counted up. For each pair, we asked how many amino acid monomers separates that contacting pair. And we just took the average over the whole protein.
Between pairs.
Between pairs. Right? Atom A and atom B are touching one another, and they're separated by 13 amino acids along the chain. Now, so we've got some average distance along the chain before the residues touch one another. That's only capturing one aspect of topology. It's sort of capturing how local on the chain is, on average, is structure. And we took that parameter, and to make it a more or less length-independent parameter, we divide by the total length of the chain. So this protein, it's got these helices in it. It's got lots of local interactions, and so the average interaction separated by less than 8% of the length of the chain. This protein has a much more complicated topology. Right? That strand goes to this helix, goes back to that distance strand. So for this protein, the average interaction is separated by more than a fifth of the length of the polymer chain. Again, this is a pretty simple metric. It's only capturing one small aspect of topology. As my colleagues who, for a living, determine the structures of proteins point out, we've taken something like 3,000 five-digit numbers of this structure, coordinates, and distilled them down into a single two-digit number. So this is a fairly naive metric of topology of structure. But it works. This seems to be that variable. And in fact, I stipulate that this works as good as any single variable model possibly could, right? We've already shown that there are order of magnitude sequence-specific effects and up to two order of magnitude sort of stability effects. Moreover, these data were collected in a dozen different laboratories at slightly different temperatures and different pH and different ionic strength. So there are all these sources of scatter, and yet no protein falls off this line by more than about a factor of 20. The mean scatters a factor of 3 out of a million-fold range of rates. We've used this correlation to blindly predict the folding rates of about a dozen proteins now, and our mean error is a factor of 3, out of a million-fold range. So this seems to be the single most important determinant of how fast these polymers fold up. Now, this isn't the only way to address this question, right? Here we've changed this contact order. We've changed topology by looking at unrelated proteins. There's another way to address this issue. We can take a single protein. We can grab one of these places where the polymer chain goes out into the solvent. We can use molecular biology again, and we can extend this. We can just make this longer and longer. Now that changes this contact order. That changes this metric of topology. Because, of course, you're separating contacts by a greater distance. And it does it in a nice way. We've kept the core of the protein the same, so the thermodynamics aren't affected very much. The sequence isn't affected, so those two sources of scatter are gone. Plus, all of the mutants were characterized in the same labs. They're all done under the same conditions, so that source of scatter is gone. This has been done for three proteins now. And when you lose those sources of scatter, in the worst case, the correlation coefficient is 0.97. Sorry, I should have mentioned the correlation coefficient for the other plot was 0.93 with 24 data points or so. The p-value is like 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 9. Anyway, so where was I? We have now a single value variable that accurately predicts the folding rates of these simple proteins. It accurately predicts the folding rates of all of them, suggesting, for one thing, that they all fold via somehow a common mechanism. All fall in the same line. So maybe there really is only one theory of protein folding kinetics we're looking for, not several, at least for these small proteins. Another issue is that whatever that theory is, it's probably relatively straightforward, right? because this is such a simple metric of structure. And it doesn't address any of the issues you mentioned. It doesn't address chemistry at all. Right? We just said a contact was any two atoms within some cutoff distance. Well, we've looked at that recently. From the perspective of a protein chemist, that doesn't make any sense at all. We know that the thermodynamics of folding is driven by hiding those greasy amino acids from solvent. So we thought, okay, it's the contacts of those greasy amino acids that should drive this process, and so it's their contacts that should be correlated. But when we limit contacts to just those greasy amino acids, the correlation coefficient goes from 0.93 down to 0.3. So in fact, every time we've tried to put chemistry into our model, it gets worse, if anything. This seems to be a chain physics issue. Another issue is that... So the more we've only looked at that a little bit. It turns out for a couple of technical reasons it's a little tough. We've only looked at it a little bit. They tend to fall below the line. So bigger proteins that go through these intermediates tend to fold more slowly than would be predicted by this, which I assume tells us something. Another issue is that these contact orders are averaged over the entire chain. So it seems somehow the entire chain is involved in that rate limiting step. Before we discovered that, I would have suspected that the ends of the polymer probably don't matter so much. Those come in last and they don't define the rate. But no, every time we've tried to constrain this definition of contact to less than the full length chain, it doesn't work as well. Not that we've seen, although it's been a long time since we've looked. If you think of anything like that, you think we should check. Let's talk later. An interesting idea. That's an interesting idea, but I doubt it, because in general the volume is simply proportional to the length, because all the amino acids have about the same volume and they're densely packed in the folded state. There is some correlation between length and stability, thermodynamic stability, by the way. All right, where does that leave us? It leaves us with a semi-quantitative, but empirically based, way to rank the importance of these determinants. We see no relationship to length, other than that rule, right, that these are all the smaller proteins. Sequence kind of affects things by an order of magnitude, stability up to a couple of orders of magnitude, and the structural metric is the single most dominant determinant across the million-fold range of rates. And that really buys us something. Yeah, hope you'll agree with me on that. That buys us something in the folding field. Historically, protein folding kinetics has had a large and rather vibrant experimental community and a rather large and rather vibrant theoretical community and a very big gulf between them. And the problem has been that as an experimentalist, I tend to study the folding of protein L, and I know that it folds at a rate of exactly 62 per second. We don't yet have any theory of folding kinetics, at least until recently we didn't, that could make a quantitative prediction like that. The theories are typically predicting things like folding rate should scale with length to the 1.5 power or so. So this semi-quantitative ranking at least gives us an opportunity to start really testing theories of folding kinetics. By the way, I don't remember if you, in your introduction, if you mentioned that I am a card-carrying theorist myself. My PhD is in theory. I always say that before I put up this slide. I love that quote. You know, you guys would definitely know. So, well, Eddington was both a theorist and an experimentalist, right? I mean, no. Just an experimentalist? Well, but he was the guy who went... Yeah. See, I always thought he was... Yeah, okay, so we... We're all just observers. Well, irrespective of whether or not he was a theorist or an experimentalist, or, like myself, both. I like this quote, and I think he meant it as a joke, clearly, but there's some truth to this, right? So I always tell my students, my experimental students, this. I've just told you a bunch of empirical observations. They might be wrong. They might be a coincidence. You should always temper your enthusiasm about empirical observations based on whether or not you've got some intellectual, some mental framework on which to hang these results, some theory that sort of ties them all together. Now, my field is also kind of contentious, particularly the theoretical side of our field is kind of contentious. So I don't make it a habit of really discussing whether or not I think any given theory fits our observations or doesn't. And maybe more accurately, I don't talk about the ones that don't. Recently, we've gotten interested in a theory that I think at least qualitatively does fit these data, called the Topomer search model. And the idea here is that you got this unfolded ensemble. So let me share. This relates to a question you raised earlier, Tony, about when a protein's synthesized, does it start to fold up as the first few amino acids come off the synthesis machinery, or does it wait till the whole chain's there? It turns out for these small proteins, the evidence is that it waits for the whole chain. If I take in the lab, and we've done this, and others have done this, if I take one of these proteins of 100 amino acids, and I cut 5 of them away from the end at equilibrium, the protein unfolds. The folding thermodynamics of these are so cooperative, you have to have at least 95% of the structure before you drop below a free energy of zero. Well, that ties into this hypothesis. We've got this unfolded ensemble. We've got all these different unfolded states. They suddenly find themselves under conditions where the folded state's favorable. They try and collapse and fold. Try and collapse, try and collapse. Well, very few of them will be in a configuration that can collapse all the way down to within 95% of the correct structure without having the chain have to cross through itself. It's a self-avoiding polymer. So my suspicion, and presently this is a qualitative suspicion, but we're trying to put it on quantitative footing, is that contact order is just measuring what fraction of all the unfolded molecules are in those rare topologies that can collapse all the way down into this well, all the way 95% down into the native well, without requiring the chain to cross through itself. And for one thing, this explains why it's the contact order of the entire protein that matters. You know, we can't even leave the ends off. It also explains this issue of chemistry. Right? There's no chemistry in this. This is an expanded chain that's just searching through solvent. And so that explains why when we tried to make contact order more sophisticated and build chemistry into it, it got worse. Now, I left one part of that story out. We actually just spent several months trying to be very clever chemists and trying to make contact order work better or at least as well by putting chemistry into it. And it never worked. And finally, it occurred to us that we hadn't done the negative control, which is to take all of the chemistry out. Right? The original definition was just any two atoms that are in contact. Well, what if we ignore all those atoms in the side chain? What if we just take the center of each monomer and say a contact is just when any two monomer centers get within some distance, 6 angstroms, 8 angstroms. So we've stripped all of the packing chemistry away. That's, of all the models we looked at, that's the only one that has as high a correlation coefficient as the original all-atom model. So I'm a professor of chemistry. I wasn't excited to get this result, but in some respects, I've been dragged kicking and screaming away from the standard biochemistry or biophysics belief that folding kinetics, like folding thermodynamics, are rooted in the chemistry of amino acids. I think that this is clearly saying it's not that. Whatever the rate-limiting step is, it depends heavily on just the physics of this expanded chain, and all the chemistry has been stripped away. I mean, my last data slide there, but of course this wasn't done in vacuo. Some of this work's been going on in my own research group here. I've been here at Santa Barbara for 2 years. Prior to that, I was a postdoc in Washington, where we first made this contact order discovery. Prior to that, I first saw expression as an experimentalist in Chris Dobson's group at Oxford, which is where those homology studies were undertaken. And lastly, actually, I didn't mention my collaborative work with Seb. And of course, I didn't characterize all 3 dozen of those proteins. We've stolen a lot of this data from the literature and from friends. People have been in this field very generous with providing unpublished results. Thank you for your time. Oh. Yeah. It certainly could be approximated as a single barrier process. But here was the slide where he just published these data a few weeks ago. It turned out no one had ever really rigorously looked at that. So about 2 weeks ago, we published a paper where we did. We threw every statistical test we could at this, and there's no evidence that it's anything but single exponential, even down as low as 15 below the freezing point. Several theories suggest that it should become stretched at that point because there should be other barriers. You know, I don't remember the answer to that. It varies a lot from protein to protein. We have recently looked to ask if those higher order moments have information content. So I've been showing you the average contact distance. We've made linear models that include the standard deviation and the skew and the kurtosis or the first, second, third moments. And those extra variables don't add any information to this. Yes, isn't that odd? You are correct. Isn't that odd? Not that you're correct, but the observation.
So why do they fall so fast?
That's my favorite question. Yeah, I mean, that was what I started here, right? Why is it 50 orders of magnitude faster than it should be? I don't know. Well, for some reason, the rate limiting step is just this diffusive search. Here's one answer. All right, this random search model says you're randomly searching through all configurations until, plop, you drop into that one tiny little hole that's the correct one. Well, that's clearly wrong. In reality, the rate's determined by how hard is it to get to the rate-limiting step. How hard is it to get to a point where you're entirely downhill to the native state from there? So that is the rate-limiting step, and it's downhill from there, that you can just zipper up straight into the... Well, yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. Pardon? Well, we are trying with there. It's tough, right? It's a transition state. It doesn't build up, so it's hard to look at directly. But we're trying both some simulation approaches and some experimental approaches to address that.
You've added conformational energy landscape. As you approach the native state, do you have one big deep valley that's bit outside, or do you have a plane with lots of dimples and maybe one little deep?
Well, that's a... That's a contentious issue in the field. And it's a little bit hard to address because this is, in some respects, a single barrier process. It's a single exponential, single barrier process. So we don't know anything about the landscape, the energetic landscape after the rate limiting step. So, I mean, it's fundamentally not addressable by experiment. The theory that tries to address it is not very falsifiable. Yes. You can do it by chemical synthesis if it's less than 50 amino acids, or you can chemically synthesize the gene and put it into a bacteria and ask the bacteria to do it. So that was... Let's see. I think it's not too much hyperbole to say that was the holy grail of a big chunk of a field called protein design. There was about 15 years of effort to try and build a computer algorithm that would tell you what sequence will fold to a given structure.
Yeah.
And that's been done for the first time about 2 years ago.
The general belief is that if you take some additive form,
yes. And that's been shown experimentally. If you just make random sequences, very, very few of them fold. How few that is, many have tried, all have failed. We've been trying to figure out a way to do that experimentally too. The answer is not many, but we don't know what the real answer is. They stay as these floppy chains. Yeah, that's an excellent question. These small proteins, actually, we don't really know the answer. My guess is that by and large, all proteins are capable of folding spontaneously and on their own. Now, in vitro and in vivo, so in the test tube and in the body, we know that if you just try and refold a protein, often multiple chains will come together and fall out of solution. Or the protein will get trapped in kinetic minima, and these kinetic minima are sticky, stick together, fall out of solution. And we also know that inside the cell, there's a whole class of proteins called chaperonins, and their job is to take misfolded proteins, use energy to unfold them, and allow them to spontaneously try it again. So for a long time, it was thought that these chaperonins actually help folding. They don't. We now know, at least for the ones we understand how they work, we know their job is unfold mistakes and allow them to try spontaneously a second time. So that makes me suspect that most proteins can fold on their own, and all these small ones do. Yes. Yes, you're right, and it fails that test. There's about typically on the order of a 10 kT enthalpic barrier. There's also some other experimental evidence that I left out that suggests that at least a few specific interactions mandatorily occur at the rate-limiting step. But multiple bits of data, including what I've just shown you, right, we can predict rates ignoring all those issues. We can predict rates pretty accurately. So while it's clear that some specific interactions occur in the rate-limiting step and some enthalpic bonds are broken, the dominant player seems to be some global issue that is somehow captured by contact order. Yeah.
Thank you.